Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Hey, everyone. Another episode of iFreaks Show. And today we have a special guest, Jordan Morgan.
Hey, how's Jordan? It going?
How's it going? Jordan recently, or well, it was in October, I think, of last year, gave a talk at TriSwift in Tokyo about the life of an image on iOS. So we got you on to talk about that. But before we jump into the topic, can you briefly introduce yourself?
Yeah. Yep, Jordan, I am an iOS developer at Buffer. It's a remote company. Small team there, just me and one other person on the iOS team. But yeah, I've been there, I guess, this September will be 5 years. And before that, I worked at a small healthcare startup doing some iOS and some Microsoft.NET framework stuff.
This episode is sponsored by Sentry.io. Recently, I came across a great tool for tracking and monitoring problems in my apps. Then I asked them if they wanted to sponsor the show and allow me to share my experience with you. Sentry provides a terrific interface for keeping track of what's going on with my app. It also tracks releases so I can tell if what I deployed makes things better or worse. They give full stack traces and as much information as possible about the situation when the error occurred to help you track down the errors. Plus, one thing I love, you can customize the context provided by Sentry. So, if you're looking for specific information about the request, you can provide it. It automatically scrubs passwords and secure information, and you can customize the scrubbing as well. Finally, it has a user feedback system built in that you can use to get information from your users. Oh, and I also love that they support open source to the point where they actually open sourced Sentry if you want to self-host it. Use the code DevChat at Sentry.io to get 2 months free on Sentry's small plan. That's code DevChat at Sentry.io.
But yeah, so I keep busy there, and I also have my blog, SwiftJectiveC, which is, it turns out, it's like the worst domain name ever because it's kind of hard to spell, but everyone in iOS, I think, kind of gets the name. But in addition to that, I also have my side project, SpinStack, which was kind of the basis for the talk you mentioned.
So what are you doing specifically at Buffer?
You know, it's all iOS, which is exactly the way that I like it. So when I was on a podcast with Sean Allen a while ago, we were kind of talking about like career transitions when you kind of move from one job to the other. And kind of my main criteria was like whatever job I go to next needs to be all iOS, you know, because I didn't want to kind of do the web dev or too much backend stuff. So yeah, everything that has to do with iOS. We have three apps right now, maybe some more coming in the pipeline, but yep, my whole day is pretty much all coding and then the other stuff, you know, that comes with work, planning and checking out features and checking in with stakeholders and stuff. But yeah, most times it's all coding. And we actually just now started playing around with Swift. So before that, it was all Objective-C. So a lot of fun stuff going on there.
Yeah, and I can imagine I used Buffer myself for scheduling mostly, but I know you guys have what's the name of that?
We've got something
app that does the image you work
oh,
with
Pablo?
Images. Pablo. Oh yeah.
Yeah. Pablo. Yeah. Pablo. Yeah. I love Pablo. I use it all the time too.
So are you working on that one as well?
No, we haven't done too much with Pablo lately, but we do have some things I think that'll come to fruition this year that kind of have to do with images and image generation, since you know, kind of the customer we serve predominantly is the companies with the online presence that sell directly to consumers, you know, like the podcast sponsors a lot of the times, you know, now that I'm trying to think of it on the spot, I can't think of one, but if you listen to podcasts, you know, you get like mm-hmm. the regulars on there. But all that to say, they post to Instagram and social media quite often and need pretty looking images. So yeah, we're trying to make something kind of in the same, ilk of, Pablo and put a new spin on it. So, I'm hoping, I'll be able to talk about that sooner rather than later, but, short answer, yes.
Gotcha. Okay. So the talk you gave was the life of an image on iOS, right? So what sort of one sentence briefly, what is it about?
It's, if I had to give the elevator pitch, it'd be what really happens with a UI image when you use it, from a memory standpoint. Like that was kind of the one liner for the talk.
Mm-hmm. So what spurred you to kind of dig deeper into that? That's a very specific, concrete niche topic on iOS, right? It's kind of
it
like
really is
fiddling with, I don't know, AV Foundation and how streaming is done.
Oh, God help you if you're doing that.
Right.
But yeah, no, it all has to do with SpinStack, really. I was adding a feature for that where there was an image in a table view, and the image, you know, the dimensions were kind of proportional to the width with some scaling. And when I added that, and to back up a little bit, SpinStack, my side project, it's a list-based app that keeps like a running total of its items. And, you know, you can drill down into items like most list apps and add like, you know, notes and this, that, and the other. And one of those things is images. And what I noticed was after I added the image support, when I would open up an item and the new view controller would show with that image, it was basically just a table view. If I scrolled really quick, you got the hitch. And, you know, that's probably another good podcast topic in and of itself, because there's so many causes of those hitches in table and collection view. It's almost like a rite of passage, I feel like, as an iOS developer, to like dive down and see what's happening there. But, you know, I tried the usual suspects. You know, I tried some prefetching stuff, I even took out like auto layout. I didn't think it totally couldn't be auto layout, right? Like it's dynamic cell height, but I didn't think that would be it. So, you know, I calculated it and used frames and, you know, I did all these things and nothing really seemed to fix that one particular issue. And it only happened with images. So that was kind of like the giveaway. All that to say, that was like kind of the tip that I needed to dive into this topic some more. And lucky for me, I went to WWDC for the first time that year, and there was a talk called Images and Graphics Best Practices, I think is what it's called. I think there's a performance in there, Image Performance and Graphics Best Practice, something like that. And I was like, hey, this will shed some light on what's going on. And basically it did. And once I kind of took a peek under the hood of how images are working under the hood, I kind of figured out that maybe the problem was the way that I was handling it and presenting it. And after a lot of fiddling around it, I got the knowledge I needed from that session to kind of dive in and look deeper and fix it up.
Is it one of those WWDC sessions that they have every year, and it's the same thing showing how to render a really large image with pinch to zoom example? Or am I confusing it with something else?
I guess we could put the link in the show notes, but no, this one has been one off as far as I know.
Okay.
Like I haven't seen it repeated. And there's another topic that they had, iOS memory deep dive, that was kind of closely related to it. And I get them confused because there's so much overlap between the two that mm-hmm. it almost like I watch them back to back quite often. But no, this one was one off. It was definitely just laser focused on UI kit, UI image, UI image view, and how they're working.
I see. So you start to kind of research on that and getting down the rabbit hole, right? So
very much.
What'd you find?
Yeah, so it's actually kind of crazy because the problem that I had at the end of the day had to do with image decoding. And if you kind of search around for image decoding or look in like, you know, headers and UI kit, you really don't see like any mention of it. And when you kind of understand how it works, it makes sense because it's like purposely abstracted away from you. You don't have to mess with it. You don't have to deal with it.
And the image decoding would be, I just kind of want to take a step back and give listeners an overview of where is that, I guess, image decoding in your mm-hmm. process and steps of using an image and displaying an image, right?
Yeah, usually it goes in three phases. So you load the image, right? And like in kind of model view controller parlance, like your model is the UI image. The view is the, you know, the image view, and the controller is the view controller. But when you load the image, it doesn't have the data that it needs to show at a per pixel point, right? So like, it doesn't have all the information it needs to be rendered onto the screen. It just has information about, like, maybe it's encoding, whether it's a ping, JPEG, it's metadata, the sequence of bytes, but it doesn't describe what it should look like. And because of that, when the UI image hands off to the image view, it does what's called decoding. And when it decodes, then you get that per pixel information. And that describes, like, how this image should actually look once it gets on screen.
And then what's the last step?
The last step would be rendering. So you load it, you decode it, and you render it. And when you go to render it, you know, Core Animation will go and shrink it down to however it needs to look. And that's kind of the rendering pipeline, is just those three core components: load, decode, and render. And then decode, again, is just kind of, since it magically happens, it's one of those things that you don't have to worry about until you do. You know, like, there's always something like that in every framework or, you know, computer science or every app that you've ever worked on. Something works for like 90% of the use cases. And mine was kind of like following on that other 10% where it wasn't working very well. And the reason for that is I actually was in a scenario where I had to worry about decoding, because the problem with decoding and the problem that I had with SpinStack is those image buffers can get huge. They can balloon on you. And when that happens, that's when you as a developer like have to worry about it and get in there and figure out how to solve it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So when you say image loading, it's really getting NS data into the memory effectively, right?
Yeah, yeah.
For the future pixels of that image.
Yeah, so like this idea of a buffer, and in this process, there's like really three to worry about. There's the data buffer, which doesn't have that per pixel information. And then there's the image buffer, which does. Mm-hmm. And the last one is the frame buffer, which is like rendering whatever you see on the screen at 60 times per second, or on the new iPads, a crazy 120 times a second. And so, you know, your app's got that deadline, like every 60 seconds, you're trying to, you know, render a new frame so that when you scroll or, you know, do whatever you're doing on the screen, you get the nice buttery smooth feeling. But image buffers can do two things. They can take a long time to do, they're CPU intensive, and they can hang around in memory. So those two things add up, and then you can't catch up to the frame buffer in time. And then you get that stutter. And that's where it's a problem. But yeah, the big picture is the load, decode, render, you know, what Apple kind of refers to as the rendering pipeline. That middle step is where things can go really wrong. But the reason I think a lot of people don't know about it, myself included, like, you know, I've been doing iOS development for a long time, and I never knew about this until I looked into it, right?
Me neither, until I watched your talk. I'm like, okay, I care about this most of the time.
Correct. Yeah. And it's funny because I almost thought about framing the talk of answering the question right up front, like when you should use this, because as you're watching the talk, you might be A, thinking, I don't need this, like my apps are fine, or B, like, oh my God, am I supposed to be doing this all the time, you know, and I'm not doing it ever.
That's actually kind of how I thought, to be honest. I know I use some frameworks, they supposedly do that stuff, but not always. Like, now I'm at a large organization and we're not really kind of keen on using open source stuff.
So sure.
Makes
sense.
I guess either we already do it or at some point we'll have to.
Totally. Yeah. And there's the thing that's nice about this topic in particular is like there's a pretty easy like chart you could follow to know when you need to do it. And when you don't need to do it is if you're using like an image asset catalog, because basically it takes care of all this for you. So if you have all of your image assets already in your asset catalog, it's already taking care of the image buffer and sizing it and taking care of it at compile time. And that kind of goes into app thinning and, you know, slicing and all that stuff that I think they started that in iOS 9, I want to say.
So wait, you're saying if you're doing the, what is it? The NS bundle thing.
Yeah. Right? The initializer that looks for the, or image named, I know off the top of my head for sure does it.
Or that, okay.
Yeah. Yeah,
so that's already up to
one if you have multiple targets, if I remember off the top of my head.
Mm-hmm. So that's already optimized because...
Oh, yeah.
Even though you effectively access it via key, which is not strongly typed. So probably compiler doesn't really know. So you're saying it actually maps and kind of looks into the assets. What is that?
JSON
thing.
Yes. And it's actually faster too. Cause like, if you think about loading, let's say if you just open up Xcode right now and you drug like an image in there and didn't put it in the image catalog. So then the asset catalog can't optimize. Basically, it comes down to the optimizations. It can't do all its smarts and its optimizations. And in this case, smarter image decoding for you, because that's just added as part of your bundle. Or not your bundle, I'm sorry, just, you know, part of your app. And beyond that, it also can't do anything like, you know, app thinning or the app slicing, because you know how there's the 1x, the 2x, the 3x, and all those images. Obviously, the app store, when you download an image, or I'm sorry, an app, it takes the assets, only the assets that it needs for that phone. So the reason it's more performant is it knows ahead of time kind of what the image buffer is going to look like. And two, it's faster because it can do like a trait-based lookup because of that app slicing, instead of, you know, searching the file directory for that image. So it's faster and it's more performant from a memory standpoint. So there's so many reasons why you would use the asset catalog. In fact, I don't even can't think of a reason off the top of my head why you wouldn't put an image in there. It's funny because we actually don't use that asset catalogs very much at all. App Buffer or my own app. I mean, I've got a few things, but it's been a long time since I've seen like just an image file hanging out outside of one.
Right. So then effectively that means you want to worry about that buffer optimization only for runtime images.
That's anything, a great way to put it. Yeah. Like anything, if you're downloading it over the wire too.
Yeah, that or anything generated by the user.
Yes. And another way to think about it too is, since I kind of go into this in the talk, but the reason those image buffers are so huge is because it has to do with the image file dimensions, right? So if you've got, I mean, this is going to be like an exaggerated example, but just to drive the point home, let's say you've got like an 80 by 80 image and it's 2.4 megabytes. You would maybe look at that and think, oh, I'm only going to cost 2.4 megabytes, but it's really not. And to draw the example from my talk, if you have I had a 1718 by 2048 image, and you've really got to multiply that by whatever the color format is of the phone. So if it's just kind of standard, like sRGB, the math on that comes out to like 13.42 megabytes, even if the file size was small. So when it does the image decoding, it has to do with the files, the image's dimensions, not the file size itself. And that's why it's so tricky to catch too, because you don't intuitively think of it that way. At least I know I didn't. I looked at like the file size, like, oh, is this a small image? You know, have I put it through Image Optum or whatever it is and, you know, crushed it down as low as it goes. But really it's just how big or small that image is. And a lot of times we're putting them in image views that are much smaller than that image dimension size. And that's also when you'd want to do it. So,
is it, okay. Bear with me.
No, absolutely.
I'm a 5-year-old here.
I was too. I mean, the talk does really well from WWDC. That kind of explains it. But yeah, I had no notion of this stuff either before.
So I'm getting NS data for an image from a URL somewhere on the web.
Mm-hmm.
It's compressed, quote unquote, meaning it contains information data about what's displayed and at what coordinates and with what color. But it doesn't, how do I explain it? It doesn't contain any extra data about empty space.
Mm.
If that makes sense. And that's why it's compressed, right? It only has only the necessary information for that image to be eventually displayed. And then when you're buffering it or getting it into that buffer, it kind of like decompresses it into what it actually is going to be, as you said, the full size of 1700 by 2400, for example. And then it not only gets all the data for those particular specific pixels and like that will constitute the image, but it also contains the information for all the empty ones as well. And that's why it grows in size.
Yes.
Right? I'm simplifying, obviously.
No. You've pretty much got it. Yeah. The part you were describing was basically when you initialize the UI image And this could be different for core graphics. In this case, it's just basically UI kit, UI image, UI image view. But when you initialize the UI image with, you know, the NS data, and then when it's tossing it over to the image view, when it's about to be displayed, that's right. when that decoding hits and it balloons it, like you mentioned.
And then at the last step, right, we're only, then you get it to the UI image. But as you said, it's smaller though. Then might be smaller than the your
and
image.
It almost always is, right?
Right. You know?
Hey folks, this is Charles Maxwood, and I just launched my book, The Max Coder's Guide to Finding Your Dream Developer Job. It's up on Amazon. We self-published it. I would love your support. If you want to go check it out, you can find it there. The Max Coder's Guide to Finding Your Dream Developer Job. Have a good one. Max out.
Yeah.
And then it gets it kind of shrinks it down again, but to scale it to display actually.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. And core animation does that part. But the overall notion of like why we would do it, I guess kind of what we were talking about is in this case, we're getting it from the wire and the image view we're putting it in is likely smaller. Let's say it is smaller because it almost always is smaller than the image itself. So if we're downloading avatars, let's say we're scrolling through a list of like, you know, people that have been on this podcast and we show like their avatar from Twitter. And this avatar is like 40 by 40 in a table view cell. But the images we get probably are like 120 pixels by 120 pixels. I think on Twitter, that's pretty common. So we're already at a disadvantage at this point because the image we're getting is bigger than the image view we're putting it in. So what the whole point of this taking control of this decoding phase is we want to downsample it and only take the memory hit for the space that we're using, right? So we don't need the 120 by 120. We just need the 80 by 80. And so depending on the color scale too, you know, sRGB or wide color aware phones, that's going to multiply this problem even more. So when we get into this technique called downsampling, that's how you kind of control this decoding phase. You say, look, I've got this image. It's 120 by 120. I'm only putting it in an 80 by 80 image view. So let's go ahead and only take the decoding hit for an 80 by 80 version of this. And that's where the image IO framework comes into play. And you can take control of that and do that. And that has a huge impact on memory if you do like a before and after using some of Xcode command line tools like VM map is one that's really good for this because it kind of spits out a diagram of where memory's taking shots at. But yeah, so like the fork in the road would be, am I getting this from my documents directory, i.e. outside of the asset catalog? Am I downloading it from some remote network? And if I am, is this image bigger than the image view I'm putting it in? If all those things are true, then decoding's going to really help you out.
I just thought of that. Actually, even if you're getting it from asset catalog, it could be bigger than what you need anyway.
If you didn't supply all the image sizes, I think that'd be true. Is that what you're saying? Like if you had a 2X device, but you only supplied like a 3X asset?
Not even that, which yes, that's that as well. But let's say the asset you upload and bundle up with your app is 1,000 by 1,000 pixels.
Mm.
But where you're really displaying it is in a little thumbnail in table view cells, which is 50 by 50. So you still have that waste regardless. And would you have the same problem then? Buffering it into 1,000 by 1,000, so it's like bigger than it needs to be, and then you shove it into the UI image view, and then it gets resized to 50 by 50.
Yeah, I think you would still, if it has that much of a separation, I think for sure you're going to have a lot of problems.
Gotcha.
In that case. So it could take a little bit extra legwork to go in there, because when you do the decoding, one thing that you have to know is like the maximum size of what it's going to be. And so, you know, if you have 1,000 by 1,000 and it's going to go in something smaller, let's say you have this image, an image like that you use in multiple places, right? Like not just a table cell that's smaller than that, but it's like a background or like a profile view of an author that you tap on. And in our example of like the list of the iFreaks guests. And there, I think decoding on the table view cell would probably make sense because I don't know offhand, I don't know how the image asset catalog decodes. We know that Apple has thought a lot about that, and obviously it's going to be very well done. But a disparity that large probably just couldn't be accounted for. But yeah, that'd be something that could come in handy.
I'm also thinking a similar scenario, but not like now we have the multi-screen thing, multi-window on iPad.
Oh yeah, I've had a lot of fun with that one.
So tell us in a second, but. I would think if you're allowing your view to be resized in that multi-window, kind of same thing. You probably want to bundle up a bigger one for like the biggest resize, if it's like your background image or whatever.
Yeah.
And then as it shrinks, you're having this problem. You still need to render it, but your viewport to render in.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Getting smaller.
It just changes. Yeah. In that case, I think you would want to decode, because one of the biggest things that we're talking about is this image view, or is the source image like the same size as my image view or bigger? In that case, it would be changing all the time. So that's a really interesting example, because that'd be good to put in a talk too, is this situation where you want a background image. Cause I personally don't run into that.
I'm just making it obvious.
No, it's great. But off the top of my head, what I would probably do is listen to the trait collection and then re-downsample it each time that it happens, so you can avoid some of that. But I mean, and that's the thing with iOS development. There's always something like that, isn't there? That you'll run into.
Right, yeah.
Some edge case, something that's going to throw a wrench in your plans. But it kind of goes back to the knowledge gap. If you don't know where to look in those things, it just gets super frustrating. And I luckily just happened to stumble upon some of the know-how on this one.
I think this one's similar to I don't remember exactly what it was, but it's kind of lingering in my memory. Something with table views or frame sizing or auto layout, one of those basically related to laying things out. It doesn't compute stuff until you assign. And then when you assign, it's like implicitly starts the execution, and that's on the main thread and you're screwed.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Yes. So
something like that. And as far as I recall, the workaround was, you call like dot size on it before.
Size that fits or.
One of those.
One of those size to, it's so funny you mentioned this, because I was looking at an example of this not even 10 minutes before we started recording. I forgot what it was for. But yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And yes, and this can be a huge problem, right? Because UIKit runs on the main thread, right? Like if you've been on iOS or around the block, you either know that or you've been bitten by it, or both. I've been bitten by it many times. But and that's why this decoding gets so interesting there, because if we go back to our render cycle, the load, decode, and render, and those types of buffers we were talking about, I kind of vaguely mentioned the frame buffer, which is, holding your rendered output. And since that can happen at 60 times a second, typically, or 120 times, well, it wouldn't make any sense to get rid of this image buffer, right? Because the CPU would have to keep decoding it. That's why those memory allocations get so large, because the UI image hangs on to that image buffer. And so if you've got all these images, especially in the table view, and they're much bigger than the source material, i.e. the image view, that's why the memory starts to spike on you, because the frame buffer keeps refreshing and, pulling from the display hardware, and that image buffer is like, oh, I've already decoded. It makes no sense to do it again. So it just stays out in memory. And if you're not careful and, you don't size them the right way, that's where it gets to be very interesting. And again, like you said, that's all in the main thread, which is why you notice it fairly quick.
Remember when we had manual retain count?
Oh my goodness. I started iOS development at that time and I thought I was going to die.
Yeah. That specific problem was, oh God. Although in a way I would say it was better than Android, because at least you controlled it and you could flush your memory, kind of force it, quote unquote. With Android, it was like this garbage collection. You could never know, when it gets deallocated and you're out of heap memories. Just shoot me.
It gets, yeah. .NET, I believe, does garbage collection too. So I ran into that every now and then. But yeah, Arc is really nice. And as soon as the next release came out where they added it, I was overjoyed, because I was learning at the time. And so I was like, oh, this retain release dance is really, really something. But it is kind of analogous to what we're talking about in a way, because it's like, exactly, it's one of those things you don't have to really worry about until you do. And in some ways, ARC has almost done a disservice to the kind of conversation around memory, because it's so hyper optimized and efficient in a good way that you almost don't have to think about it. But you will at some point, you know, like you're going to create a retain cycle or do something to where you really have to dive into it and figure out, you know, kind of how ARC is really working. And it's kind of like the same way with the image decoding. And until you've been hit by it, you know, you don't really think about it.
So your solution in the talk was ultimately a category extension, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I kind of abstracted it out just to off a UI image, I think, is what I had it.
Okay. UI image or UI image view?
It was UI image, because the UI image is what's going to crush you on the decoding. If if you need the smart decoding, that's where you would want to fix it.
I was almost thinking like Apple should do that, you know, for us. And I understand that, that there's this step. I almost like see, because I looked at your solution, it's like layer core, CA animation layer or whatever it's called.
Yeah, it just uses image.io to create what's called thumbnail. So yeah, the CG image source create. CG. Yeah.
So basically you're like, you're creating a blank canvas, you're pushing of the size necessary. You're pushing pixels or sort of taking that NS data and saying, okay, given my size that I want to canvas of the canvas that I want to render on, put this data in and optimize.
Exactly. That, and it's nothing more complicated than that. It's just saying, I know the size that I've got. I know that the asset catalog isn't going to optimize this for me. So I'll take control of the decoding. Here's how big the image buffer should be. And that's all it does. And another pro of this is, you know, how we were talking about earlier, how the image buffer hangs around, you know, since it keeps re-rendering. Using this technique, it actually discards it when it doesn't need it anymore. So you get the other benefit of not having that memory allocation hanging out. So the decoding's a little bit easier on the CPU, and the memory's better all the way around for all the reasons we've kind of listed. But yeah, you've absolutely got it. You say, here's my image, here's the size I need it at. Let's create what's called a thumbnail to represent that. And you get back the CG image, but you just wrap that in an image view. A UI image, and pass that to the image view.
Right, exactly. So yeah, this is why I thought, well, can Apple just have that under the hood?
Say exactly.
When you initialize, basically my view of it is like UI image view init with data.
Yeah.
And maybe a param for size or something.
Yeah, I think the reason they haven't is because you have to know the size. So, I mean, I guess they could do an overloaded, you know, initializer or just add one that has a size to it, since this is so intrinsic. Because that's what decoding always comes down to, right? It's the size that you need to show the image at.
Actually, yeah. So, out of layout, everything's dynamically sized. Mm-hmm. How do you go about this then? How would you know your image size to fit it in?
So if it's always going to be varying, I think the best rule of thumb is to take the closest estimation you can get. So if you're going to put it in a table view cell, I would say it would mirror, I would pass whatever you use for estimated cell row height. And I can't remember the API name off the top of my head, but I do this in SpinStack. I do have the benefit of knowing how tall it's going to be even before I've scrolled to it, because the math for that row is just what's the width of the table view. Make that the same height. So it's just a one-to-one aspect ratio. So I do a few things. I do the prefetching API to do the downsampling. And then I, again, pass it the size, because I'll know the size at that point by looking at the trait collection. But yeah, if it's going to vary, even if you do a close estimation, you're still going to blow away whatever the memory would be for image decoding without it. Blow away in a good way, I should say. Much smaller.
Right. Yeah, I'm just thinking of something at work that I'm struggling with. I have a collection view. Every cell in it is equally sized and the size is predetermined, except one that's dynamically sized at the very top. And that freaking thing, I have to I basically end up rendering it, and then it's of a wrong size. And mm-hmm. then when it sort of assigns all the content to all the UI texts, roughly yeah. speaking, or UI labels rather, then I kind of get a callback back to the collection and say, well, now refresh so that you can ask that thing for the actual size.
Size is, I mean, we've been turning tricks for a decade on table views and collection views, trying to figure out how to optimize those things. And that's one reason I was so excited to see the new advances there for iOS 13, which I know at like our normal jobs, you know, like at Buffer or at Wayfair, probably can't use them yet because, you know, we're one OS back.
Swift UI, that stuff?
Yeah, sorry. No, I was thinking of the compositional layout stuff that they added.
I haven't looked into that. What is that?
Basically, it just makes the collection view, you just kind of compose bits and pieces to create whatever the layout should be. So most of the time, like if you're like me, you just use flow layout and just kind of do the switch inside of like how big the row should be and kind of fake it from there. But this one allows you to make things like the App Store is a great example that I think I've seen used in the talk at WWDC and mm-hmm. you know other conference talks of like a great use case for it. You can define like the axis. So if you want it to be horizontal, vertical, and then you just describe like how big each item should be in each section. And you just kind of add these building blocks together to return one object that basically just describes the whole layout. You know, so you don't have to override a ton of methods to kind of get the same result as we had to before. Because making those custom layouts always is, you know, an exercise in frustration, usually, at least it has been for me. And this just makes it very, as the name suggests, composable. It's really, really good. It's funny because I don't really use a lot of collection views myself, but I really liked it. So I almost was trying to figure out a way in my own side project to just kind of shove a collection view in somewhere so I could play with it some more. But, and the other thing I was mentioning was the diffable data source, setup that they announced. And that's probably my new favorite API. In the past year, that one's been great to use.
That's the one where now you're never gonna have index out of bound type of
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, yeah. So
supposedly
that's the dream, right? Yeah, it really gets rid of batch updates because those are I was gonna say impossible. It's not impossible, but it feels impossible to get those
it's
right.
Annoying.
100%. It is because there's so many things you have to remember. And it was funny because there was a talk at WWDC 2018, a tour of Collection View, where one of the devs at Apple, obviously behind Collection View, did a really great talk on how to do that perfectly, right? You know, update your data source in the closure, make sure you do the insert, or I don't remember the exact order, but it was like, you know, do the inserts first, then the sections, then the deletions. And after you watch that, you're like, that's still really hard, you know, but the diffable data source just throws that out the window and you basically get a snapshot, you add stuff to it and you call apply and it figures it all out. I'm rewriting some parts of SpinStack with that now. And I had a tweet that was hilarious. My old diffing code was like 150 lines and the replacement with diffable data source was like 15 lines or something like that. It was a lot easier to follow.
Are you building applications with Vue.js? Then you need to check out the Views on Vue podcast. Every week, we bring in a guest panelist from the Vue community and talk about the interesting things being built with Vue or the changes coming in its ecosystem. You can find it all at viewsonvue.com.
Yeah, I think we kind of covered most of your talk, right?
Yeah.
Anything else we missed?
One thing that I thought was interesting to note is you mentioned Collection View. And a lot of people, when they see this talk, I think the first thing they think is, oh, I'm going to do this in my table view or collection view, you know, for each cell, because that's like a great use case for it, right? And there's one kind of gotcha there that I didn't get to talk about it in the talk. I just ran out of time. And I wrote a blog post over some of this, and I briefly mentioned it. But basically, you can get into some issues there because when you're doing the decoding, no matter which way you slice it, we kind of mentioned it's going to take a hit on the CPU. And if you do those in waves and spikes, that's where we really start to drop frames. And what's a lot better is if you get like a nice smooth demand on the CPU. And a great way to do that is to kind of pop this decoding to a background queue. And this was one of the first things I thought of, you know, when I went to do this. And of course, that's a great idea. It solves the problem. But if you don't make the queue basically just serial, you can really run into some issues, because when you scroll a whole bunch of times, and obviously, you know, collection views, even more so than table views, are going to have quite a few rows. You can end up hitting the situation called thread explosion, where basically you're asking the thread.
That doesn't sound good.
Isn't it like one of the best names in computer science? Right? Thread explosion. You know, you can really kind of name drop that at like a user group or something and sound like you know what you're talking about. Yeah. Oh, you got to avoid thread explosion. But basically, all it means is you're trying to parallelize such a hard word to say. I never get that right the first time. Work over more CPUs than you have, right? So like if you have an 8-core phone and you're trying to spin up like 16, 32, 64 threads, that doesn't work. So my one nugget that I didn't get to talk about in the talk was use a serial queue if you do that. It'll be a nice, smooth, constant demand, and it'll actually save you a lot of hassle. Because again, like the collection and table view is just a great spot to use this. But I'd be doing a disservice if I didn't mention that.
That reminds me of there's this framework that I used on one of the projects called Texture.
We use Texture at Buffer almost in every single view in the whole app.
Finally, I found someone else.
Yeah.
Thank God. Okay, then you know what I'm talking about. That thing's fantastic.
Yeah, it's great.
It's just computes all of your stuff to render all of the frames in the background. And you just get the final result, and you will, roughly speaking, apply those frames to your views. Done.
Yeah.
It's magic. It
really is. It's crazy how fast that thing gets. And it uses some of the same ideas of around images in the framework. And, you know, it's funny, though, since you use Texture, one of my favorite things is I think people come to Texture for the performance, right? Like, that's why they end up going.
Yeah, I mean it's... It's like scrolling dynamically sized tables. That's when you get to it.
And that's a perfect use case at Buffer, because all of our rows are dynamic in height, because you create social media posts, right? Mm-hmm. Do you have one line, 10 lines? Do you have an image? Do you have a link? Texture was a great help for that. But one of the things I like most about Texture is just the layout API, you know, how you create these layout specs and you return those. Goodness gracious. I think... Like if I could even use UIKit and just use the layout specs, I would almost even like that more sometimes.
I know, right? And it's they're predictable. They're like saying they work as you think they should. Like you just
they're easy to reason about.
Assumptions are safe, exactly. Like with auto layout, no matter how many years I spend, it's like never what I think it never does what I think it would.
You never get it right the first time, right? It's like you go at it a few times, or if you miss a translate auto size resizing mask defaults, if you miss one of those, or you know, you don't worry about any of that. And that's one reason why, not to pop topics on it, is why I'm excited about Swift UI, because the layout is kind of the same. It's like a V stack or an H stack.
Exactly. It's linear layout with one direction or another, effectively. Yeah.
I mean, of course, Texture is like fully featured several years in. So there's so many things you can do. Almost all of Buffer is written in Texture. And it's composable too. Like you can reuse those layouts a lot, which is really, really nice.
Have they moved to Swift, or are they still Objective-C?
The source code is written in Objective-C++ for the most part.
Okay.
But you can use it with Swift. As I mentioned earlier, we just now started using Swift at Buffer. We're waiting for the ABI compatibility and, you know, all the other reasons why, if you haven't used Swift yet, those are kind of well known. But it works just fine in Swift. We really, really weren't sure kind of how it was going to go, more or less. We were a little hesitant about it, but it's funny. If you look at Texture's issues on GitHub, most of the code samples are in Swift. So I would imagine it's pretty battle tested there. But no, it's been with the expressibility of Swift and the ease of use of those layout specs. Oh, it's nice. It's really fun.
Now I almost want to make some social media app just so that I get to use it.
Oh, yeah. The day we stopped worrying about like registering cells and, you know, trying to get the layout right on our layout for those and cell reuse, which is another giant pain, another source of a million bugs. It was really good.
Well, you know, Pinterest is now a public company, publicly traded. They're not going to go away too fast. So they'll just maintain this. It is fine.
They're going to have to. Either that or they're going to find themselves having to rewrite their entire app.
I don't think it's probably going to be many years before they are able to do anything like that with Swift UI anyway.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because it makes you wonder with the new Swift 5.1 features like the function builders and, you know, this DSL type of functionality, like, could you plug that in for texture or vice versa, like make texture work with it? You know, there's so many crazy ways that all that could go.
Suspect no, and I have not dug deep into Swift UI yet, so I don't know. But I know in Apple, I assume, and likely I'm like 95% right on this one, it still renders all this stuff on the main thread anyway, just like how the layout does, and it means it still sucks in that regard.
You know, it's crazy because I think you're right. I think it is. I think it's been confirmed, actually, on one of the leads. I think Josh Schaefer is his name, said that it is all in the main thread. I don't know if that'll change, but the person who wrote Core Animation is on the Swift UI team too. And there's something, they're doing something crazy with it to make it optimized. Like, I think they use Metal in some parts. Mm-hmm. Because speaking of image decoding, when Swift UI came out, I did just a quick test and did a UI kit version and a Swift UI version. And the UI kit version didn't do image decoding on purpose. And, you know, neither did the Swift UI version, but the Swift UI version used a lot less memory. So I don't know what kind of wizardry they're doing under the hood for images in Swift UI, but it's definitely different.
Well, we shall see.
We shall see. That you just summed up Swift UI as a whole, I think.
Yeah. All right. I'll withdraw from my personal opinions on it. I'm probably so loud about it everywhere, so people know. It's like,
They know where you stand, huh?
Not a fan.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's got to have some time to bake for sure.
Okay, great. So how can people reach out to you?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at JordanMorgan10, and also my website, SwiftJectiveC.com. And if you didn't get the joke at the beginning of the episode when we were talking about it, it's just Swift and Objective-C mashed together. So I've got a post called Optimizing Images is the title, where I talk a lot about what we chatted about today. But yep, Twitter's definitely the best way.
Nice. And you guys can reach us out on Twitter at iFreaks, and I think we have an email that I kind of forgot, but we'll
give
put it in.
Try.
Yeah, we'll put it in show notes. Picks. We're doing picks. For me, Witcher, great show. I just binged. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
It's well done. Great acting. Nothing cringy, nothing too much of like some stuff that they try to promote or whatnot. It's great. Like, so far,
it's got that viral song too, right?
The song. Yeah. And I think the other day I saw a cover, like a rock band cover or something of that.
Nice.
It's just great. Just great. So yeah, highly recommend if you have Netflix or if you pirates, I don't know, either way, just
watch it. Watch it. It's Superman turned into a big Witcher.
So here's the thing, if my friends would not have told me, I probably wouldn't kind of recognize him, to be honest.
Oh, Henry Cavill.
Yeah, it's like it's just completely different kind of look. I guess the chin is the same, but other than that,
he kind of looks like he's got the pointy ears going on too, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
yeah Good one. I might have to watch that because I love video games, so I'm familiar with like the Witcher franchise on there, and I know there's books and stuff, but I haven't seen the show yet. I'm more of a sci-fi guy myself, so I think my pick will have to be in that realm. So I finished Watchmen not too long ago. Really enjoyed that.
So
there's a new series on HBO, and it's based on the same source material as the movie is, the graphic novels. And I think it recognizes the stuff that happened in the movie is more or less, but anyways, yeah, it was really good. It's from Damon Lindelof, who did Lost, which I love, and a few other shows. He's kind of known for those twists and turns. And that's what hooks me is that when an episode ends with like, oh, come on, I got to know like what happened, or, you know, so it really has that factor going on. So I watched that and it just finished its first season. And then I read on Twitter, they're not going to have another season. So I'm kind of bummed about that. Yeah. I guess Damon Lindelof doesn't want to do another one, but that would definitely be my pick. Very, very good.
Great. All right, guys. So yeah. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Awesome. Bye. Thanks.
Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit CacheFly.com to learn more.